Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. This is our 12th episode, and today's guest is Kate Samuelson. She and her business partner, Georgia Weiss, created the newsletter Cheapskate London 5 years ago. Today, they have over 18,000 subscribers. The newsletter goes out once a week and features two free events happening around London for every day of the coming week. As always, thank you for listening and enjoy. Okay, so I've been doing my research, read a bunch of back issues, read about you, etc. But I'd love to hear in your words, who is Kate Samuelson and what is Cheapskate London?
I mean, a great first question. So I'm Kate, but I also like to say that I'm the Kate in Cheapskate. I am a UK-based journalist and also the co-founder of Cheapskate London, which is a free weekly email newsletter that curates the very best free events happening in London each week. And that can be anything from film screenings to plays to comedy nights to quirky one-off events like a food giveaway. And I launched Cheapskate almost exactly 5 years ago with my school friend Georgia, who's a graphic designer.
Yeah, I was curious about how you and Georgia split the work, because I noticed like you seem to be the public facing figurehead. Like it's your email and the Twitter bio. I noticed that, you know, when you guys won an award a few years ago, it was you who won the award. But my impression is that you guys split the duties pretty well. So yeah, just what is the demarcation there?
So we founded Cheapskate together. And we're actually really old school friends. We've known each other since we were 11. So it's really nice all these years later to be running a business together. I do all the kind of partnership stuff, outreach, monetization, also all the copy writing, kind of the day-to-day things like that that go in the newsletter, liaising with different PRs. And then Georgia does everything visual. So she does the look and feel of the newsletter. She designs it and has come up with that whole brand identity. She does things like our decks and media kits. And she also does a few smaller things like liaising with competition winners and some PR outreach as well. And generally, we split things. I have a two-thirds stake in the business and she has one-third stake. But we're, you know, very much partners in every way. We talk about all big decisions. We speak about, our WhatsApp is full of kind of social plans mixed with Cheapskate. It's actually quite hard sometimes to differentiate between the two. But yeah, we work really well together and we've been doing it together the whole time.
Okay, so you guys split it up. She does the design, a bit of a mix of everything, two-thirds. That's all good. I'm also curious, like, who else helps? Because I saw a post from a couple of years ago after I was like on your Instagram after you'd gone on BBC to talk about the newsletter or something like that, and you tagged your now husband, and like I couldn't tell if it was jokingly or not, recommend or noted him as the social media manager, and I imagine there was like some truth, some joke in there by the tone. But I know he's a journalist too, so I'm sure like maybe there's some sometimes help, but like less about him in particular, more besides you and Georgia, who are the other collaborators, if there are any? What do they do? How do other people help you?
That's a very insightful thing to have picked up on, because I would say the only proper other collaborator is my partner, Tom, who we joke is our unpaid intern, because he actually does a lot for the newsletter. He proofreads it normally every Sunday. And he's also a journalist, but he's an incredible writer and editor. So it's helpful to just have his pair of eyes on it before it goes out. I think it's always really important just to have a second and if possible third pair of eyes before you send something, because he'll often find typos and small things that need to change like that.
So he
works really hard on it and doesn't really get any credit, but he's kind of like the unofficial third member of the team. Apart from the three of us though, it's just us that work on it.
Oh wow, nice. I mean, I guess you guys have it pretty covered with the copy and the design, which the design, by the way, is like is really good. And I couldn't find, I mean, you switched to Beehive like in December, and so I could see the archive on there, but I could only find one older issue from like 4 years ago or something on your LinkedIn. And the design, I bring it up because the design was basically the same and everything about, like, it hasn't really changed very much. Am I correct that, like, you haven't really added or taken away much? It's been this, like, two free events of every weekday, like maybe a little bit of intro. I think you've added, like, kind of this affiliate link section and a little bit, but, like, the format and even the look has been pretty consistent for 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of surprising, I think, because when you set out and do something, you obviously expect to have many iterations. And as you mentioned, we have tweaked a lot over the years, but not kind of in a major way. So the main format, which is featuring two free events for every day of the week and then just two for the weekend and having a competition somewhere in the middle, is sort of what we started with. But we did actually, as you mentioned, introduce this editor's letter at the top because we realized that people really like hearing from me and Georgia, and when we share kind of personal stuff about us and what we got up to on the weekend, I feel like it really helps us build a relationship with our readers. And it's actually been a really important section that I didn't even think of including when we first started out.
Yeah, bring a little personal touch to it. Speaking of your readers, I understand that, like, your audience is probably largely, you know, people with an interest in free events in London. So that could be students, people who just don't have much money to spend or don't want to spend much money. But how would you define who your reader is at a high level?
So we call our readers Londoners and what do we call it?
Sorry. Not cheapskates.
We call our readers Londoners and London lovers because there are a lot of people who, I mean, there's still a small proportion, but there are still readers who don't live in London, but still like to kind of have a feel of what's going on in the city or might visit London often. So like to know what's going on for that reason. And even though obviously the newsletter is all about free events, I would say our readers aren't necessarily people on incredibly low incomes. Certainly a lot are, and we get a lot of messages from readers saying how useful it is for them to be able to still go out and live life to the full. But we also know that a lot of our readers are just people that like going out and doing things, and they're culturally curious people who like to immerse themselves in events and new experiences and just want to have a kind of sense of all the exciting things that are going on in London. And the reason that I decided to actually create Cheapskate in the first place, the kind of inspiration for that came from me just searching for free things to do in London and not finding that information readily accessible anywhere. And that's kind of where it sprung from and where the idea iterated. But actually, since then, we've realized that we appeal to a huge range of people who are just wanting to know what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. There's a lot in there I want to get back to in a little bit. But first, so that's like the high level of your reader. But how about like on an individual level? Have like strangers ever like stopped you at the street or something? Or have you, I don't know, hosted events? Like, who have you met some of these people in real life, like who you didn't know previously? And what was that like?
It's quite funny actually when that happens. It doesn't happen a huge amount, but it has a couple of times over the year, or over the years, I should say. Most recently, I was actually at work having lunch with a colleague who I hadn't met before, who's a freelancer. Just talking about, you know, what we get up to. And I mentioned that I have this side hustle, and he was really shocked and said that he'd actually been reading it for a few years and, you know, couldn't believe I was Kate from Cheapskate. So that was quite funny. And my mum's had a funny incident recently. She's a teacher and was talking to some of the other teachers in the classroom, and one mentioned reading something on Cheapskate. So it's nice when it goes full circle like that. It feels like sometimes when you send out the email, it goes out to all these thousands of people, but you actually don't know them. I mean, obviously a huge proportion of my friends and family subscribe, but I mean, outside of that. So it is quite nice when you kind of meet a reader in the wild in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of who our readers really are, it's a huge mixture, but I'd say our most typical reader is female. That's about 70% of our readers and in their 20s. We know that Cheapskate would appeal hugely to students, but from what we've seen, I wouldn't even say that a huge proportion of our audience are students. They're people kind of first or second job in London, working and in their 20s. But we also do get messages from people who are in their 50s, 60s. So I think we do have quite a wide readership, and that's something that I'm really mindful of when I pick the events as well. I try and make sure that there's something there that will appeal to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, with picking the events, I know that you, like in some other interview, you said you kind of do your vigilance, you go out and search, you have these like places you track, you get some PR pitches as well. I'd love to hear how you choose an event other than like, this is something that seems cool, it's free, and it's in London. Like how do you balance, like what really makes it in and why?
Yeah, it's become a lot easier, I'd say, the longer that we've been doing Cheapskate for, because at the beginning, I didn't have the contacts, I was doing a lot of my own research. And now, because we've been going for 5 years, we fortunately do get a lot of event organizers and PRs reaching out to say, hey, I'm organizing this cool event. So I have a calendar, that's just a Google calendar. And throughout the week, as soon as these emails come in, or we're also subscribed to lots of mailing lists of all the major galleries and museums and event spaces in London, as soon as I see free things happening, I'll drop them into the calendar, so that when I come to write the newsletter, often a lot of great events are in there already. And then it will be a matter of thinking about things like having a good mix of events. You know, I don't want to have 12 events that are exhibitions. I want to have a bit of cinema, a bit of comedy, a bit of theatre, a quirky exhibition, maybe a late at a museum, that kind of thing, making sure that there's a real balance. I also try and make sure that there's a spread across the city as well. We've had feedback before saying, you know, I'm in South London, you feature so many North London events, that kind of thing. So I now try and be really mindful of having them spread across the whole of London, and having a few in central as well, with the idea being that most people can reach there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these are the kind of things that go on in my head. Also often events, even though they're free events, they'll have kind of tickets that you have to book. And so I really don't want people on a Monday when they open Cheapskate to see an event they're interested in and go to book it, and then it's kind of sold out. What's or the equivalent point? Of whatever that is for a free event. So I'll try and see how many tickets are left and gauge whether there'll still be tickets available by the time the newsletter goes out on Monday, and whether it's worth including an event that might only have a few tickets left and then readers will be disappointed. So a lot of that kind of thought goes into it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll have good relationships with certain venues, and we like to prioritize those events as well, especially ones that are run by people from minority ethnic backgrounds, or there are some kind of LGBT events as well that we prioritize. We again try and really prioritize diversity in our newsletter as much as we can, and I just really wanting everyone who reads it to feel represented in some way. So that really goes into the choice as well.
Yeah. Complicated algebra, so many things. I'm curious, like if you have this calendar, how many, like, I don't know, just for example, like on one, let's say on like this Thursday or whatever, how many events did you have like booked aside where you're like, okay, I've got this many to choose from to pick the two?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say probably on a given day, we probably have around 10 events to choose from, maybe 8 to 10. And given that we're only picking two for each day of the week, and then just two for the weekend, sometimes making that decision can be really difficult. So I want to include them all, but I'm also very big on looking at the analytics, and that's something that Beehive has been amazing for.
Like what people always, are clicking usually.
Exactly. So I'll always be going in and seeing which events are most popular, and then using that to inform the events that we feature.
What's like recently, what kind of thing has been more popular?
Last week's, or actually I should say this week's event that was most popular didn't surprise me, but I think I was still slightly surprised to see how popular it was. I mean, I thought it would be one of the most clicked on, but it was, you know, maybe it got three Far times away. As many clicks wow. as any other event. And that was a cinema in, or kind of an arts community center in East London has launched this mystery cinema night where you turn up on a Wednesday and you don't know what film you're seeing, and they kind of drop clues throughout the day on their socials. And it's really fun, really quirky, but there was a lot of interest in that event in particular.
Yeah. One more question about the events. I'm sure you don't go to too many of them. I mean, you've got a full-time job and you're doing this and, you know, you've got a life. What was your favorite of these events that you've curated that you've been to recently?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think I went to something good recently. Let me just have a think.
Actually, too, like on that, how often are you going? Again, like I said, you've got a full life yourself. So I don't know, how often are you going to one of the events that you've curated?
Not as often as I would like to go.
Yeah.
And I also do find that's something quite difficult about doing what I do, because I'm promoting events often before they've happened. And so I don't know what they're going to be like a lot of the time for one-off events. Obviously, if it's the kind of exhibition or something, then it will have been, we tend to promote it on the day that it opens, but sometimes we'll promote things that have been running for a while.
Yeah.
So I do often worry about sending people to something that ends up not being great. And we have had a couple of
terrible artists.
we've had a couple of instances where people have emailed, and actually I kind of respect the tone. It has never been accusatory, but it's been, you know, just as an FYI, I went to this event. We had one recently where someone said they went to an event and it wasn't very good. It was free to get in, but then you had to pay for a lot of stuff when you were there, and it ran late. I think it was a burlesque night. And
well, that's kind of amazing though, that your readers are like giving you this kind of feedback and like care about it, and also like being respectful. It's like, because you're doing a community service, right? So like they understand that and want to contribute.
Definitely. And I really appreciate having that feedback, because then it makes me think, okay, well, I'm not going to feature an event run by that company again in the future. So we kind of, yeah, exactly. We need people to let us know what they were like. And actually, that's something I kind of wish I was able to do more. I'd love to have someone at the events we feature to kind of take a feedback form from our readers there. I mean, obviously it's not really possible at this stage, but I would love to know more. And we actually do have a kind of line at the bottom of the newsletter that says something about us, you know, the events being external to Cheapskate, and we're just kind of the messenger. So, you know, but we don't want to be held responsible for things like the event time changing or an event being cancelled, because we obviously just can't have oversight of everything free happening in London all week.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do. Okay, I want to go to your career for a bit, because you're like a career-long journalist. You studied journalism in school. You got a master's in magazine journalism. But before we like go all the way back there, the entire time you've been doing Cheapskate, you've had a full-time job, except I think there was one stint where you were working just part-time. How do you balance it? What is the balance there? Like, how much time are you spending on Cheapskate per week on top of your full-time job?
It can be really difficult, and it can also vary depending on what we've got going on. I would say I probably spend half a working day a week on Cheapskate at the moment, but because often that's kind of split up into different, you know, sending an email here, an email there, and then the writing, it's hard to really quantify it. I've always done Cheapskate as a side hustle, so I don't know what it would be like to have more time to spend on it. I do know that I'm very grateful to have my business partner Georgia so that we can work on it together, and we also have flexibility. You know, if one of us can't work on the newsletter for whatever reason, we can either work ahead together or we can just take a break if we want to. We try not to, because I think it's really important to be consistent. But earlier, we've had one week off this year, which was in April when I went on my honeymoon, and it just,
congrats.
Thank you. It just wasn't feasible for me to write it when I was away. So we do have that flexibility. And I also feel like I'm in a fortunate position because I work from home 2 or 3 days a week. And that means that I'm saving time on commuting to an office. And I try and use that time a bit like first thing in the morning to respond to some emails. And I would also say, as I said earlier, because we've been going for a while, actually writing the newsletter and doing the outreach takes a much shorter time than it did at the beginning. And having so many events to choose from, yeah, exactly, it just makes it so much more straightforward when I come to write the newsletter, which is usually on a Saturday morning.
Yeah. Okay, going all the way back, like I said, you have a master's degree in magazine journalism, which as somebody who, like, you know, writes feature length things and I just love magazines, etc. This will connect to, you know, back to the newsletter eventually. Tell me like about what that was and like what you learned from that like brought you down this path of, you know, of journalism and like particularly newsletters now, both in your side hustle and your, you know, professional career. What did you learn there that kind of, what was that like? It sounds fun.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I always knew that I wanted to be a journalist, I think from when I was maybe 16, 17. And then when I went and did my undergraduate, I was really involved in student journalism. Again, I just loved it. I was on the student paper and I also edited the student magazine. And so I think that was a real flavor of being in the world of journalism. And I've tended to do more of the feature side of things than news, although I did actually start out as a graduate trainee reporter on a major newspaper here in the UK. And so that was a really interesting experience. But from then on, I've tended to do more of the feature side of things. It's funny because I did my master's, I think it was around 10 years ago, and I don't remember newsletters being discussed at all in my course. Yeah, even though email obviously has been around for a long time now.
I feel like newsletters were like this like 90s, early 2000s thing, and then it was blogs. And like when you were getting your master's, it was the blog era, and like the newsletter era was about to start again. And now it's like, it's all the same thing, but now it's just newsletters again, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think when I was doing my master's, we were talking a lot about social media. That was kind of new, the way that journalists were using it, which is funny to think about now. It makes me feel quite old. But so email was a kind of side thing. And I think it wasn't actually till I joined The Week magazine a few years ago as an editor for the digital team that I actually began to see newsletters as being a specialism within journalism that I was perfect for. And that was even when I was still working on Cheapskate and in my spare time at that point, I still didn't really think of newsletters as being an area of journalism that I should throw myself into. But The Week has a lot of amazing newsletters, which I got involved in, and I ended up becoming their first newsletter editor. And I think that was a really big step. I was worried at first, is this going to pigeonhole me? But I actually think now that promotion was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I went on, all the jobs I've had since then have been newsletter focused, and it's such a growth area in journalism at the moment, despite the fact that email has been around for such a long time.
Yeah, well, you specialize, and then it's also like, I mean, when I took this job too, I that was something I wondered about, like, will this be a positive or a negative to like be just like a newsletter specialist? But I think it's definitely a positive, like not only because, you know, it's a great time for newsletters, but there's so much else involved in it of like, you know, it's like you're learning like very specific, like how do you reach this audience? How do you learn like if they're liking it? It's a healthy thing to do. But going back, so you were the first newsletter editor at The Week. Tell me more, like what does that mean? What is that role?
So I was involved in the launch of a few of their culture newsletters, which were food and drink and travel. And I also, I'm trying to remember now because it was a few years ago, but I also edited the Morning Briefing newsletter as well, which was there and still is the flagship newsletter. And I think I learned a lot then about, as you said, appealing to different audiences and being able to talk directly to readers and how important that can be for a brand and a brand's identity. I think that what I love so much about newsletters is that you're just not at the whim of social media. You don't have to worry about an algorithm changing and your content not getting shown to people, because if you have people's email addresses, you're in. And
yeah, well, that's
have
the problem
that
in the first place, though, right? Is you have to get them.
Yeah. Those. Yeah, it's hard to get them, but once you've got those emails, then you're there. And I think it's obviously really important to build that relationship. I think it's easier to do, knowing that you have time to build it and you're not worrying about the algorithm changing and, you know, losing losing oversight of your audience in a second, which is what has happened to so many brands and so many social media platforms.
So many URLs dashed on the rocks of the pivot to video. So did you get that newsletter editor role in part because you'd already been working on Cheapskate for a couple of years?
I think that that did play a part in it.
And in your interest, at least, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think the role came up and my manager at the time, I think, thought that it would be a good step for me. And I do, it's funny now to think about how unsure I was, but looking back, it definitely was the right decision. And that actually took me to my next role, which was editing a newsletter first media publication.
Editor-in-chief, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think I would have had that responsibility, or I don't think I would have been in the running for that responsibility had I not been a newsletter editor already.
Mm-hmm. So that's the no we're talking about, right? And one thing I thought was interesting was that was the first startup you'd worked at. What did that teach you? Like, not only like this being a newsletter dedicated thing, organization, but also it being like maybe a different atmosphere in being like a newer startup. What did you learn from that experience that you like take away now?
Yeah, I learned so much from it. It was a really amazing experience. I learned what it's like to be in a team of five people, where you're everything. You're not only editing and writing, but you're HR, you're IT support, you play all these different roles. And so that was really interesting for me, because before that I'd only really worked for big companies. So that contrast was a great learning experience. And I learned a lot about the newsletter world and how there are lots of emerging newsletter startups. And I think being one of them was really exciting, and being able to immerse myself within that was great. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot about things like Beehive, for example. I hadn't heard of it until I joined the No, and the founder had heard of Beehive, and I worked on that.
What is the thing? What do you value the most that you took away from that? Maybe like about like two things. One, about producing and writing a newsletter, and then two, about like just working, given it was a new work environment. Two learnings.
I'm trying to think, they're quite like intertwined in my head.
Mm. Well, it could be one.
So I think a big learning for me was about prioritization.
Mm.
And when you're a really small team, you can't take on everything. And you really have to think about what is actually a priority for the company. And that's something that I've definitely taken through to Cheapskate now.
Mm.
'Cause, you know, for example, before 6 months ago, we were spending quite a lot of time on our Instagram, but it wasn't really doing anything for us. We weren't getting great engagement. I don't think the crossover between our audience, in our readers in the newsletter, and our Instagram audience was very similar. It wasn't growing our newsletter subscriber base. It was kind of just there for show. And I think the No really taught me about, if something's not really doing it for you, you don't have time. Focus on the things that are actually going to reap rewards for you. So we've really stopped doing any Instagramming recently. And I can't say that I've missed it. I don't think it's impacted the brand and the newsletter at all. So that was a huge learning, to just really see what is actually going to be important and grow your business, and everything else put to the side for now.
Yeah, no, I talked to somebody like a month or two ago, this guy Andrew Huang, who is a big YouTuber. He has like 2.3 million YouTube followers. He's been doing it for like two decades, but I mean, since YouTube started. And I asked him something about that, because like, he's mostly just on YouTube. He has some presence on the other platforms, but like clearly doesn't prioritize it. And he was like, I don't know. It was the way he said, just that like he realized one day that he just didn't have to do those other things. And it was like this huge weight lifted, and like this revelatory thing. Because I mean, with Creator Spotlight too, I do the same thing. Like I'm trying to be on all these platforms, and it's really hard and exhausting. And like, you're like, sometimes you feel like you're shouting into the dark. But with Instagram, though, you do have almost 9,000 followers there. So something maybe was working there, but was it just that, like you said, the audiences maybe weren't the same, and any new people weren't coming to the newsletter?
Yeah, we used to post on Instagram all the time, most days. And so we built a lot of our audience through doing that. But I noticed over the past year, our engagement really dropped. And I think that's something that's quite common among quote unquote micro influencers. Yeah. And I think
not doing enough
it's really hard when you're not spending tons of money on Meta to get that engagement. And for us, it's not worth putting our money into growing our Instagram. You know, we don't have tons of money. We're a tiny team of two people, but any money that we do have to spend on growth, I'd rather spend on getting newsletter subscribers, because that's what's more important to us. And then if people want to go and follow our Instagram, that's fair enough. I'm not going to, you know, deter anyone from doing it, but it's just currently not a good use of our time. And if we were to expand the team later, then that's something that we'd look at growing again.
Okay, so now let's take a little stats detour, newsletter numbers. I'm curious how many subscribers you have, the open rate, and the click rate.
So we currently have 18,718 active subscribers.
Oh, wow.
We have, well, our open rate is currently, I'm just opening my beehive. Like, I can just read you our open rates before. It was 56.7, 52.5, 45.1, 49.6, 53.9. So we were consistently hitting over 50.
Yeah.
Our open rate has been consistently above 50% for a long time. And our click-through rate is really high. It's 16.3%. But that's actually down from what it's been in the last 4 weeks. We often get around 20% click-through, which my understanding is that's really high.
Well, that's quite good. Yeah, because I think industry average is more between 1% and 2%. But like, obviously, what you do is your service is providing links for people to click on. So it's like, you know, quite people expect to click a link. I wonder, this is something I was talking to somebody I interviewed last week, who this woman, Haya Kehlani, who has she curates like video essays, 5 video essays a week. We were talking about like different ways, different like metrics she could track or segments. And with you, I wonder if it's like subscribers who click every week, like, or like the click rate of individual subscribers, and like how many people are like clicking to one event per month, 5 events per month. That could be something interesting to look at, which
yeah,
I guess
that does sound
I was just gonna ask, like, is there anything else you track besides those three? Like, are there any special segments you have like that or anything?
So we're not great at doing all the technical stuff, but we do have a segment because we've been making more money recently. We've been investing some money in paid social, and that has been bringing in newsletter subscribers, which I can talk about a bit more in a sec if you're interested. But we have a segment to track how, like, the kind of the stats on the audience who we've brought in through paid social, because obviously, if we're spending on gaining people, but then 60% of them are unsubscribing within a month, then it's not a good use of money. Yeah. So we've been tracking it that way. But luckily, the unsubscribe rate is pretty low. I think it's around 3-4%. Oh. So we're happy with that.
Yeah, that's good. So I would like to talk about growth. But so my understanding is kind of the chapters, just by looking at the publicly available information, like the interviews you've done and such. So by August 2020, I read about 15 months after launch, you had 4,000 subscribers. And then by January 2023, so 29 months after hitting 4,000, you're at around 10,000. And then today, another 16 months later, you've almost doubled that 10,000 again to, you know, let's round up to 19,000. So is there like, I mean, that's just an arbitrary, like, when you did interviews, what I'm looking at.
Yeah, but that's helpful for me to hear, though, as a reminder. It's like,
if it's like, are those like chapters of your growth, would you say? Because I think most importantly is like that first 0 to 4,000 was rather quick, a faster pace than those other two, you know, chapters I included. So I guess walk me through if like from the first stage of growth, maybe to that 4,000, and then to the, once you hit 10,000, and then from 10,000 to now.
So until we, well, actually, to be honest, until we hit 10,000, we didn't do any paid social. So all that growth or if we did, I can't even remember it because it was so
in those interviews you said that was actually something you often said, that you'd never done any paid growth at all.
Yeah, we didn't have regular money coming through. We did have partnerships, but we were just putting everything back into the company, and we were being very conservative with spending. And so we did grow to 10,000 pretty much by word of mouth. So that was our readers telling other people about it. It was also we've been doing a consistent weekly competition since we launched, and a way that you enter the competition is by referring people. So we were doing that. Since we moved to Beehive, actually, it's much easier for us to actually track that person has made a referral. So yeah, we grew through that. And we also were lucky to have quite a bit of media coverage, especially over the pandemic when we pivoted to virtual events. So we had some great coverage around that time in places like the Metro and on BBC London Radio. So that really helped us grow. But it was slower than the growth that we've seen in the last 6 months, where we've grown probably by 6,000. And that's because we have been able to invest money in paid social. And we have a great ad that Georgia, my co-founder, made. And by great, I mean,
well, it's
she
working.
Won't mind me saying this. Well, it's working, but it's pretty basic. It's scrappy. And you can tell that it's made by people that are not social media
experts. Like cheapskates.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's actually kind of done the trick for us, because we have a CPA of 17p, which is super low. And and we've been also, it's not good practice again, but we've been running the same ad since October, and it does, you know, the CPA is always 17p and it does really well for us, which again is not the learning. You're meant to be mixing that up. But for us, it's been working, and, you know, if it ain't broke, plus neither of us really have time because we both work full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. The idea of creating another ad right now doesn't feel like a priority when this one is doing pretty well.
Well, also neither of you, I'm just guessing neither of you had experience running paid social ads before, right?
No, we hadn't. So that's been a big learning for us.
What was, yeah, how did you figure that out? Like, I mean, it's clearly working for you, but like at the start, why did you decide to do that? Other than just like, was it just like, it's time to do this, we want to grow? And then like, what was it when you were like going through like the fog of paid social war at the beginning?
So what made us decide to do it was that we won a big prize at the end of 2022, I want to say, which was called the Georgina Henry Prize for Digital Innovation. And that was a prize organized by Women in Journalism. And as part of that prize, we won £4,000. So we thought, okay, now's our time to actually spend a bit of money. And I put a call out for someone who was an SEO expert. Not an SEO expert, a digital marketing expert. And we found a woman who set up some ads for us, but we didn't really at that point spend much money. It kind of came later. We still weren't that confident to put that much behind it. So almost a year after that, we started actually throwing ourselves into paid marketing, and that's something a project that George, my co-founder, has kind of led on. But
this was in fall of last year, by the way, you said.
Yeah, this was around the time that we moved. It must have been just before we moved to Beehive, or around the same time,
like November.
Yeah, exactly. And we thought, okay, well, let's get that going again.
One more thing I want to talk about with growth. So it sounds like that's been the big driver recently, but then before it was word of mouth, which this is a very like word of mouth friendly thing that you do, right? But I want to talk more about the little giveaway competition things. I think you, in your little like recap of 2023 email, I think you said you did like 42 of them last year, which would be not quite every week, but most weeks. And it seems like it's a, like, you know, because there's all these referral programs people do with Beehive allows you to set up where it's like, you know, for 10, you get a tote bag or whatever, this kind of thing. But yours is so much more like scrappy and also like instant and desirable and like time limited. And like, it's pretty clever, I think, because it's like, of course I want a box of donuts or a bottle of gin, or these are just two of the prizes I know you've given out. So yeah, it, it seems really cool. Tell me more about your referral program giveaway combo.
Yeah, so it's one of those things when we launched 5 years ago, I thought we're never going to be able to do a competition every edition. And somehow it's happened. And again, it's become much easier because the longer we've been going for, the more variety of brands we've worked with. So the more people get in touch with us. It's actually more people getting in touch with us to run competitions now than us reaching out. But because we're on so many mailing lists as well, when we hear about something coming up, I'll often send a reply saying, this sounds great. Can we have 2 tickets to give away in Cheapskate? And that's often how they come about too. At the moment, we're not charging brands for the competitions, but I think that that's something I should think about doing, because obviously it is a great slot in the newsletter and it's going out to almost 20,000 people. But the way it works is our readers enter the competition by referring someone to Cheapskate. And so after
a few
days...
Do you get
like
an extra entry for every referral or just one?
It's just one, but that's actually a really good idea. Maybe for the more attractive competitions, we could do that. We also have feedback recently from someone saying, I've referred everyone I know to Cheapskate, but I still want to enter the competition. So I'm not really sure how to please everyone with this. But BeHub does make it super easy to track whether someone's made a successful referral. So a few days after the competition goes live, we'll download our recent referral, like the spreadsheet, and check, and then pick someone at random from there, and they'll win. And often there'll be several winners, but it's just a nice way of rewarding our readers. I think it gives people a reason to open the newsletter. Yeah. It's nice because obviously then we're getting in touch with individuals to let them know they've won. And I think it helps remind readers that, you know, Cheapskate's being run by real people. And then it's also obviously a great way to build our list because of the referrals that our readers make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A reminder too that Cheapskate's being run by real people who, if I'm correct, don't take any money still from it, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so right. I want to talk about monetization. So my understanding is you have affiliate links, which I think that's what the and for dessert section is at the end. You have like a dozen, maybe not as many
as
a dozen.
Not all the links there are affiliate links. So the and for dessert section, which comes at the bottom of the newsletter, but it's often our most clicked on section, despite coming at the end. That's is where we'll share affiliate links, but we'll also intersperse that with, this restaurant's doing 50% off from Monday to Wednesday, or this brand's doing a cool sale, that kind of thing that might interest our readers but isn't technically a free event, so can't really go higher up in the newsletter. I mean, it also might use that section to do some cross promotion with a brand that we, you know, there might be a brand that's mentioned us to their audience, so we might want to give them a shout out at the bottom there. Yeah. But yeah, affiliate links tend to go in that section, and that's how, or actually it's not really affiliate links, it's more pay-per-click ads go in the bottom, and that's how we make the majority of our money at the moment.
Okay. And then the other ways that you get money, I think, are you have some like buy us a digital cup of tea CTAs, and then you have a premium subscription option, and then you run some direct ads. Like We've both run the Rundown AI ads in our newsletters. it's those Beehive ads, the buy us a cup of tea CTAs, and the premium subscription options. Is there anything else?
Yeah, we also do partnerships with brands. So for example, we've had a few this year, and we've got one coming up in 2 weeks with the South Bank Centre, which is a big cultural centre here in London. So we're quite lucky to have worked with some really big brands that tend to be cultural spaces or event organizers, and that partnership tends to look like a banner advert at the top of the newsletter that either the brand will design or we can design in-house, that will have a track link. We'll also reference the event or company or whatever the advert is depicting in the editor's letter as well, using the track link again. Mm-hmm. And that might also run across a couple of weeks. So that's another way that we make money as well.
Yeah. One way that maybe it sounds like you don't make money with this way yet, but maybe you're curious too, I think, is I'm more interested in this idea of like brand partnerships. And like you were saying, like maybe a brand is paying you to promote their event with tickets or something. But when I was researching you the other day too, I was thinking about like, what if there's like a, you know, just for example, like Spotify or something, like Spotify wants to like throw this free concert to promote something, and they're like working with you and you're like the main promotion, you know, the main promotional avenue. And that's like this big brand deal where they're like paying you guys however much money, and then you can reinvest that in these, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just kind of rambling and I don't know exactly what that would be, but are these kind of like bespoke brand partnership free events? Is that something you have on the horizon or are thinking about doing?
Yeah, I would obviously not say no to Spotify if they came knocking, asking us to help them promote an event. Yeah, I think that would be definitely an area that we could go into. I think at the moment, it's great that some big companies like South Bank Center are taking a punt on a newsletter like Cheapskate. And I think they have every right to, because we have such a targeted audience and we do have a track record of getting people to events. But because we're not a traditional media brand, often I think budget is kind of reserved for the old school newspapers and magazines. So I am so excited when someone does want to promote something in Cheapskate, and it makes me feel excited that people have an open mind and are willing to invest in new media. But I also know that it's a good idea for them too, because I'm confident that our readers will click on the link, go to the event, give feedback if the brands want as well. I mean, Beehive is amazing for that with the polling function. Mm. We've managed to get so much feedback on different things. We use it a lot. And again, I think that's something that old school media doesn't have.
Yeah. I guess the next question there then is like, okay, you've been doing this for 5 years. It's been a side hustle the whole time. I know that you've said before, like a long-term ambition is like Cheapskate Manchester, Cheapskate Edinburgh, Cheapskate Berlin, New York, etc. That sounds like it's still like a long-term, faraway goal, given that this is, you know, you're still working full-time. Both of you have full-time jobs. But my question is, what are your goals or ambitions for, let's say, for the end of this year? For the end of next year, which would be 2025, right? And then for 5 years from now, so doubling what you are now.
So for the end of this year, it's such a good question. Probably should know the answer to this, but off the top of my head, I think something that we did, so we did our first ever double edition week last week,
where
we sent
special.
Out a special, exactly, we sent out a bank holiday special, which was very well received. And I think now that for various reasons we both have a bit more capacity, I think that's something that we want to do throughout the year. We want to do more doubling up, because more emails we send, the better relationship we build with our readers, and we only get money when we send out the newsletter as well. So there are lots of reasons why it's a good idea. But also, ahead of bank holiday, ahead of summer holiday, we always get emails from people asking us for that specific information. So we're going to provide it. So I think we'll do one for the late May bank holiday as well, the August bank holiday. I'd like to do a summer special. So I think we're going to experiment more with sending additional emails to our current list. So that's a plan for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Next year, I have quite big plans.
Mm.
I would really like to expand, not necessarily geographically, but I'd like to expand in terms of subject area. So something that I've really wanted to do for a while, but I just haven't had time, is to launch Cheapskate Parents, because, I mean, that's a working title, but we get so many parents writing to us to say, what can I do with my kids that's free? And I think, again, having more targeted audience is not just attractive to possible partners, but also I think it could really help us kind of make a name for ourselves in that world. And I'd like to have a kind of Cheapskate spin-off that focuses on parents. I'd also like to do a specific food one as well, Cheap Plate. So if anyone reading or listening is interested in sponsoring either of these editions, we're open to that. Love to discuss. But yeah, these are kind of ideas in the pipeline. We have a few other spin-offs too. And as you mentioned, we also would like to expand to different cities. We're actually in conversation with someone at the moment about possibly launching Cheapskate in a different city. But that's a very back burner conversation right now.
Keep it secret. Don't drop the city.
Yeah.
So one thing on my mind as I was researching all this was like the problem of like it being free events and like people having the expectation of not wanting to pay for stuff, etc. I don't think this like, you know, cuts off like any monetization opportunities, etc. But like eventually you can't just do this for the rest of your life like for free, right? Like you're putting a lot of work into this. You've put so much work into this over the past 5 years. Do you have any worry about the fact that like because people have this expectation of it being a free event or a free thing, then it's harder to attract advertisers or sponsors? I think the answer is no. So I'm kind of answering my own question, given like what I was saying about like a, you know, like that Spotify example. But do you have any worries about attracting like long-term monetization with it being about everything free? Or do you have plans to like monetize more?
I did worry about this when we started off, but I don't anymore because our audience is so incredibly engaged that we are doing really well from pay-per-click advertising and from affiliate links and recommending and making recommendations through Boosts and other platforms. And that is enough for us to, we could be taking a salary right now if we wanted to, which is obviously amazing to have got to this point after 4 years of not being there, but now it's literally paying off, excuse the pun. And so I feel like it's great that we can make this money without asking our readers for money, because obviously, you know, it wouldn't feel natural for our brand. We can never charge for cheap effect. We can never charge people to receive Cheapskate because it would be a complete contradiction. And we want everyone to have this information at, you know, the root of Cheapskate is to help people get the most out of London for free. And I want everyone, even if they're on a low income, even if they just lost their job, even if they're a student, I want them to feel like every night of the week they can go out and do something amazing. So we'll never charge to receive for people to receive that. But as long as we keep up the same engagement, I think that we can keep monetizing in the way that we have. And I think while some brands might be put off by the name Cheapskate, it hasn't really been many. A lot of brands get it and get that Cheapskate is actually a positive thing. And it's not about people cutting corners. It's about people. Value. Yeah, exactly. About value. And I think, you know, the fact that we've had big brands already interested in working with us, I feel like the bigger our audience gets, the more that will happen. So I really actually don't worry about that in the long term.
Okay. I want to ask for a few pieces of advice. So one, you've been, I mean, not only with this, but now professionally, you've been doing like dedicated newsletter work for a few years now. Do you have any like very specific tactical advice for other newsletter creators in any way, just your most like arcane specific newsletter advice?
I think it's all about the subject line. That's obvious. But
okay. Yeah, wait, I'd love to hear you talk about like the art and science of the subject line.
So I think short and snappy is always better than long-winded. And I think you don't always need to describe what the email contains. It's about giving people enough of a flavor to intrigue them. And
what's the best one you've ever written? Sorry.
Oh, such a good question. I can't think off the top of my head, but with Cheapskate, the way that we've worked out the subject lines is we tend to now just pick out a couple of intriguing events that are happening, but we don't explain them. So it might say something. There was one recently that I found quite funny. It was, it was Birkenstocks, Yorkshire burritos, and a board game museum late.
Sounds like the last one's self-explanatory.
Yeah, Birkenstocks, like, is that an event?
Yeah.
I mean, people love Birkenstocks, so that actually got a great open rate. And also Yorkshire burritos. I didn't know what that was, but there was a Yorkshire burrito giveaway happening. it's, you know, food, a new food brand. So
I've seen,
I think
TikTok.
picking out quirky things like that does intrigue people. And so I think that's better than saying food giveaway, shoes,
yeah,
shoe workshop. I think the more specific, the better, the punchier, the better as well. And I think sticking to 40 characters or less as well as a general rule.
Yeah. Okay, tougher question. What has been your biggest failure, misstep, or regret running Cheapskate?
I think not being brave enough to invest a bit in paid social from an earlier point, because it took a long time to get to 10K. I'm proud that we did it through word of mouth, but that took around 4 years, and we probably could have done it so much quicker if we'd spent a bit of money that we'd made rather than being so cautious with it. I think now, obviously, it's great to be able to spend that money knowing that we have regular money coming in, but I think I should have been a bit more of a risk taker with it, and we would have grown a lot more quickly.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. How about any one, two, or three, any lessons you've learned, not necessarily just about newsletters, they could be, but like about life or, you know, London or creativity, whatever it is, journalism, that you've brought back to your main jobs. Any lessons you've learned by virtue of running Cheapskate for the past 5 years?
I think I've mentioned this earlier, but people are really interested in the personal. So even though Cheapskate is not at all like a Substack where I write about my life, and I'm quite a private person, so I don't really like putting personal details in it. If I do mention something, for example, I mentioned that I was getting married, I got so many nice emails from readers, but it did remind me that people do like knowing that there's a person there. And in my current job, I send out emails on behalf of a major brand. I'm still taking that with me by I'm taking that thought process with me by having a way that readers can provide feedback, and then I respond to it personally. And I think no matter how big the brand is, people like to know that their email is coming from someone. So I think making it as personal as you can, and as in a way that, you know, you're comfortable with. You don't necessarily have to reveal lots of personal details, but having, you know, an anecdote or a rec of something you did on the weekend every now and again, people really do like that.
Yeah. I think that's one of the best advices, the pieces of advice for like newsletters and just writing in general. Like when I was in college, I took this intro to cultural anthropology class my freshman year. And like one of the things that's always stuck with me was like the professor said, just like write the specific and the reader will universalize it. And I think that's what that is too. It's like, I mean, with a newsletter, you're really like, you're writing to one person who's opening it in their inbox, even if there's, you know, 19,000. That's good advice. I guess we're about done here. So thank you, Kate, for joining us. Thank you, listener, for sticking around to the end. And where should people find you or the newsletter?
So you can subscribe to Cheapskate at www.cheapskatelondon.com. We're also on Instagram at cheapskate.london. But as I mentioned, we don't use it that often. And yeah. Oh, I'm also on Twitter at Kate Samuelson.